Are there any questions about any of that stuff, or? All right.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about the Israeli-Canadian Free Trade Agreement and what exactly are the goods that are exchanged between, you know, what, and is it, are some of the goods coming from Israel actually Palestinian produced just with an Israeli label? Because that happens a lot where it has an Israeli label, but it's actually exploited Palestinian labor. So I was just wondering if you know about that.
It's difficult, or like that's a whole big problem in like the investment kind of talk everywhere, is that what is actually Israeli, what is from the West Bank, and how can you tell? And you actually, I don't think you can you? I don't think they're labeled any different, because all the products that come out of Israel, even if they come out of the West Bank, they still go under the Israeli side of things, so they all have the Israeli stamp, and you can, I think it's really hard to tell.
I was just wondering if there's anything documented that says, you know, this is actually coming from a settlement in the West Bank that employs Palestinian labor.
There's no research, right? And because the Palestine Solidarity Movement isn't this
yeah.
I mean, it's not the massive movement that we all want it to be, so there's not the resources for people to, like, to actually carry out extensive research on something like the Canadian-Israeli Free Trade Agreement, as there was on NAFTA or the FTA, right? That, like, I think what people actually know about it is very just straight up, here's a couple of facts. We know it exists, and we know the gist, and because our analysis around what free trade is in anywhere, that what it's going to be. So there really isn't the research, and not a lot of people actually talk about it. So there's not much, I don't think there's really anything documented around the Canadian-Israeli Free Trade Agreement.
One thing we didn't mention, sort of Canada's involvement, is the Canadian Highway Infrastructure Corporation, which is involved in building in Israel or in Palestine settler-only roads. So I mean, like, that's a pretty key part. Like, they're involved in a consortium or whatever, but, like, I mean, they make a pretty tidy profit there, so. That's an example of Canada's complicity in the occupation.
And then it's also like it's two ways, where like Canada gets these contracts, right? Where Canada has contracts with the Israeli Air Force for its telecommunication systems. And that's like under the Canadian-Israeli Free Trade Agreement. It's like worth $70 million. Another corporation called CAE is involved in building flight simulators for the Israeli Air Force as well, particularly for the Apache pilots. And we know what those Apache pilots do. I mean, there's only one thing that, you know, Apaches are ever sent in to the West Bank to do, and that's to kill activists, to rain terror on Palestinian cities. So, and there's other kind of, I mean, and a lot of it too is very like high tech, so not a lot of it is like exploited Palestinian goods. It's a lot of it is like biotechnology, chemicals, pharmaceuticals. So there's a lot of that, and there's another thing under the Canadian-Israeli Free Trade Agreement that is kind of for that, like for private, public, joint country kind of research and development. So, which is also really scary as well.
I was wondering, I guess too, if it was, you know, in a lot of the West Bank settlements, there's a lot of organic agriculture. And I know in the U.S. we get a lot of organic agriculture, and it says it comes from Israel, and it's coming from settlements in the West Bank. So I didn't know if, you know, I mean, it'd be something to look into.
Totally.
So yeah, you know, a lot of times, you know, I don't know if you get organic produce from Israel and Canada like we do here. Usually it's coming from settlements if you see organic agriculture. So, just something to look out for.
Yeah, no, no, totally. Yeah.
So, a quick question. I don't really know too much about Canadian perspectives on these issues. Like, you know, most Canadians I meet are a little bit more progressive, and they see Canada as standing outside of empire, and, you know, kind of, you know, being progressive and, you know, more neutral, things of this sort. And they seem to, you know, allow Canadians, not in activist circles, you know, either, but they seem to have a better grasp of international affairs than most Americans do. And I was just wondering, like, what your sense was, like, is this information just so invisible to Canadians, or do they kind of know that this exists, that Canada is actually involved, but really, and don't really care?
Yeah, that's actually like the next part of what we're going to talk about, so we'll get into that, and then we can have a discussion about it. Did you have something? Did you have
your hand up? Oh, yeah, I mean, just as a comment, I don't know if you guys are getting into this later. Actually, maybe I'll save it, yeah, if there's a discussion.
Okay. Actually, yeah, so, like, do Canadians know about this kind of stuff? Like, sort of, like, the general population? I'd sort of say no. Or, like, I think it's a really strong sort of mythology that people really hold dearly in Canada. Like, this is part of, like, the national identity. Canada, you know, founded the peacekeepers. We go and create peace in the world, all this kind of stuff. Anytime we've gone in, it's for humanitarian or benevolent purposes. And people really hold on to it really strongly. And so, like, in terms of, like, the anti-war movement, I think, like, personally, I think the anti-war movement had a lot of, like, there's millions of people protesting around the world before the invasion of Iraq, but, like, the sort of rhetoric or, like, analysis around it was pretty poor. It was, like, one, if the UN says it's okay, it's okay. Two, we're not even going to think past, like, the initial invasion. Like, we're not going to think occupation. We're not going to think this and that. And so that really created, like, a hole in what would happen after, and that really, like, sort of defeated these movements. And particularly in Canada, a lot of people sort of built their sort of, like, stance against the war without this kind of knowledge, right? And so, but people who had, like, sort of, like, an understanding of all of this saw it as even more problematic, because it's, like, no, like, this government has this history. We actually know all the stuff it's already helping the U.S. with in this particular invasion of Iraq. We already know about Afghanistan. And so in that way, there was even, like, a greater sort of, like, vacuum that needed to be addressed. Because, like, in Canada, we can, there's a really, people, George Bush came to Ottawa in last December, so about a year ago, 8 months ago. And like, that was the thing. It was like, George Bush, get out of Canada. You know, we'd be so much better off if we just weren't as close to the States, you know, like, we just follow them too much. If we just did our own thing, it would be great, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, it's like, it's so frustrating, right? And so I think that is a serious issue that needs to be addressed within sort of, like, the Canadian anti-war movement specifically. And
people saying, oh, Canada, the police.
Yeah. Yeah, like, stuff like that, and you're like, whoa. And so, like, there's a lot of patriotism in Canada. And so that's, like, something that I would say is, like, for, like, radicals or whatever, need to do a better job of that, or, like, that needs to be something that has to change. And so, okay, so, yeah, so it's, like, so that's what sort of getting, like, our group questioning. It's, like, we need to sort of address these problems. We can't be effective in an anti-war movement and make a sustainable movement that's addressing, like, a whole other state's issues, right? And especially when stuff is happening at home, happening abroad. And so we started bringing that analysis, because it's like, you know, you had these millions of people, you had all this potential, and it just fell flat. And so we want to sort of think of ways of how to address that, be more creative, be more effective, build something that's sustainable and longer lasting, and that sort of, like, deepens the politics. You're gonna get into our specific group. I don't know. Did you have any more questions about it, or?
Okay. So the kind of, I guess, or the response to that, and I mean, in Montreal there was a much more long, before us there was Bloc the Empire that had started and doing work around Canadian involvement and Canadian war profiteers and the occupation of Iraq, and also bringing, you know, those direct action politics and looking at corporate involvement. But in Toronto, it took us a while, and we finally started the June 30th organizing committee, and hopefully we started it in the hopes that we can merge a lot of different politics and a lot of different analysis around the war in Iraq. I mean, one in particular was that it was going to be an occupation, and that in a broader way that it wasn't going to be sovereign. I mean, why we picked June 30th even as our name and as the day for an action was that that was the supposed handover day, that this was the day that Iraq was technically going to be free of occupation, and that that there was going to be a free Iraq, when that was a farce, and that that was something we also had to expose, and that and then in trying to expose that, and that there was going to be continuing occupation, what's Canada's role going to be in that occupation as well? So, I mean, we called it the day America hands Iraq over to America, and that a lot of things were going on in Iraq at that time, and that there was still this attempt to put in place a certain, like, neoliberal agenda within Iraq, that the marketization of Iraq, the privatization of the occupation, in a sense, through, I mean, mercenaries, through even talk of MIFTA, the Middle Eastern Free Trade Agreement, that was expected, that they were going to speed up the agenda, that if, I don't know if people remember the World Economic Forum meetings in, was it July 2003 in Jordan? Talk of speeding up the process of the Middle Eastern Free Trade Agreement because they thought they would have a grasp on Iraq, that the there was the Hudna, or the so-called ceasefire in Palestine at that time, that they would actually have a grasp to reset the neoliberal agenda in the Middle East. That all went to hell in a handbasket, but that was kind of, and reinvigorating kind of the kind of creativity, the diversity that was going on in kind of the anti-capitalist milieu during, like, the anti-globalization kind of movement, that this was something that was needed to actually kind of re-spark an anti-war movement and that could keep it ongoing. So we created the June 30th Organizing Committee and have that as kind of like our day, our first day of action, and try to make it as diverse as possible, not just in terms of actions, but also in terms of the politics and the kind of the issues that we were going to involve, that through different corporations, that we would look at different aspects, and looking at things like, we kind of did a snake march through the financial district during the afternoon that was focused on a series of corporations, not just involved in Iraq, but involved in Palestine, but or involved in kind of elements in Iraq and other places, such as Group for Falk, which is kind of a security, a private mercenary firm, and try to link it with who also run kind of immigration jails here in Canada, the Celebrity Inn, which is kind of a jail that holds about 200 refugees and immigrants.
The jail is actually called the Celebrity Inn?
Yeah, it's an old hotel. They changed it to the Heritage Inn now. So working with groups, kind of making the links between those issues through those corporations. Another one was Globrisk, which is a mercenary firm that has an office based in Toronto. And it was, I mean, the mercenary involvement in Iraq is huge. It's the largest, I don't know if people know that, it's the largest private army since the formation of the state is actually in Iraq, that it's the second largest troop amount in Iraq is mercenaries. It's 50,000, which ranges from elite special forces, that actually a quarter of JTF, the Joint Task Force 2, which is Canada's kind of special ops, the crazy guys with the crazy weapons running around, that a quarter of them had quit to become mercenaries in Iraq, because the pay is four times more than what they'll get in the military. And the U.S. was experiencing actually the same problem as well, that here were also the mercenaries weren't just kind of grunt, like, underpaid security guards, but these were the kind of the deadliest of the deadliest, you know, elements within Western militaries who are all signing up to be mercenaries in Iraq. And I mean, the deaths of those four supposed contractors in Fallujah that sparked that uprising, and also the invasion of Fallujah, were all mercenaries as well. So taking a look at like that element and kind of deepening not just the state's involvement in the war in Iraq, but also that there's other interests in the war in Iraq as well, and looking at beyond just oil, the actual economic interests in Iraq, and looking at Nortel and the Palestinian connection as well, looking at a corporation like InterHealth and like private healthcare in Canada, and also the kind of opening up of the market in Iraq, where they were trying to make bids for private hospitals in Iraq, this Canadian healthcare corporation. So, I mean, everyone was trying to get their hands in Iraq in terms economically. And there was, I mean, one more corporation that...
Yeah, like, basically, I think, like, sort of whenever a government has, like, a sort of, like, a market or, like, a certain niche it wants to protect, right? Like, these sort of neoliberal politics go out the door. So we have, like, the Canadian Commercial Corporation, which is basically, like a crown corporation that subsidizes and facilitates contracts with foreign governments. So anything over like $150,000, you have a direct contract with another government, you go through the Canadian Commercial Corporation, which gives your company like the stamp of approval of the Canadian government. And so you see a lot of this with like arms traders, like whatever, all these kinds of munitions, like support systems, tactical systems. So like companies like Bombardier, GE, like all the sort of like big names in Canada, SNC-Lavalin, will go through the CCC. And so that's like the direct link of like the Canadian government and the corporations like profiting from war and occupation. So like any Canadian company that has a contract with the Pentagon goes through this crown corporation, and like the people in Canada subsidize it through the tax dollars or whatever, which I think is an important thing to think about. And so like with all these companies going in, like it's important to think about the privatization of war and with mercenaries, and like that's a different aspect of like politics that we want to sort of like bring into it, right? It's not just like war is wrong, war is morally wrong, but it's like, you know, you don't just like go and fight a war and leave, like globalization follows, right? And so like that's like another route to address, and I think a lot of people have like that kind of knowledge, and we should be like an understanding of that, and that should be incorporated into it too. So I guess, and so should we go on to the SNC part?
I mean, the day itself was somewhat a success. It wasn't like a mass demo or it wasn't a mass movement, but it in Toronto it began to really, at least for groups talking about other types of international solidarity, that they actually couldn't get away from Canada. So in terms that it at least began to spread that analysis out to the rest of the left, maybe not in a very broader sense, not until like much, much later, which I'm not going to talk about, but like did it actually able to penetrate, like in terms of, like mass media or corporate media, like the politics that we were trying to put out there. And there was pretty much a media blackout, even though it was a really intense day in terms of police presence, where they shut down almost the entire downtown core, and there was only a little blurb in the, you know, one corporate media. But I mean, we were putting those politics out there in a very, very big way that other people couldn't ignore. The rest of the left, the mainstream anti-war movement, couldn't ignore as well, that they actually had to be like, okay, maybe we do have to start talking about Canada. We won't talk about it like the way they talk about it, but it did begin to actually have a ripple effect, and continues to do so.
Yeah. And then so something that we worked on for a lot last year was an anti-SNC-Lavalin campaign, and sort of mentioned SNC-Lavalin before, and that's sort of like a more national thing. SNC-Lavalin is kind of like the Bechtel or the Halliburton of Canada. It's like this huge engineering corporation that has its hands all over the world, blah, blah, blah. They have a subsidiary called SNC Tech, which is a munitions manufacturer. And they got a deal with the Pentagon to make, it was a consortium of like four companies in total, to make 300 to 500 million bullets for the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. because the U.S. had sort of, the U.S. produces its own bullets normally, but they only have a capacity to make something like 200 to 400 million per year, and they needed like 300 to 500 million on top of that. So they contracted that out. So this is something, again, that would go through the Canadian Commercial Corporation. And so SNC Tech is located, its head office is in La Gaudelle. No, the munitions plant is in La Gaudelle, Quebec, which is just up the road from Montreal, like an hour outside of Montreal. And so sort of some group, like our group from Toronto, Block the Empire Montreal, and then a group called Catapult in Ottawa sort of worked on this campaign, and it became more of a national thing because SNC-Lavalin is kind of this interesting company because they have offices in pretty much every Canadian city, every sort of major Canadian city. So people who were sort of doing campaigns against them in Vancouver because they're, you know, building this RAV line that's going from the airport to downtown, sort of displacing a lot of people in the neighborhoods and stuff, and it's only for, it's for businessmen coming down from the airport, and it's like for the Olympics and that kind of stuff. We're getting in on this campaign because they saw it as a good potential, right? And so it was a good chance to like build a broader network and like sort of like get people who are working on similar issues together. And then SNC-Lavalin had their shareholders meeting on May 5th in Toronto. And we had a demo for that, and it was probably like, it was a really successful thing. We got a lot of media attention out of it. We had someone who, like, we had a demo outside, you know, your typical rah, rah, rah. But we had someone, like, from the group go inside, and it was like the angry, indignant shareholder, and people like, you know, we're like, wow, I can't, you know, just like, the Canadian public would be very disappointed to know, whatever, just like this kind of like, I'm an upset citizen kind of talk, which actually really worked in our favor. And like, obviously, I think in the game that we're playing, or like what we're trying to do is like get these politics out to like a broader level and like make it an issue for like the broader anti-war movement, because like, you know, like these broader anti-war coalitions really have the pull, and like you can't fight that, like that's just how it is. And so we need to sort of push them to have like these sort of like politics that focus on Canada. So I think we were successful in that, in getting that out. And I don't know, SNC shares fell by like $4 for the next 4 days. I don't think you can attribute